mother's medicine cabinet, and I'm your host, Frank Reardon, and it's brought to you by the Literary Underground and all those nice people out there. That was the Rolling Stones' Live With Me. Tonight is our guest is a fantastic poet, John Dorsey, and I think I'm just going to bring him on now. John, are you there?
Yeah, Frank, I'm here.
All right, cool, man. How you been?
Okay, man. I wish that wish the Rolling Stones could have kept playing. You know,
go ahead.
No, I was just listening to them all day. So
it's a favorite band of mine as well. I kind of dig them a lot. So I haven't seen you in a few years. I talked to you much. What have you been up to?
You know, just busy trying not to go crazy like all of us. I think you know, a lot of sadness, a lot of funerals, as you know. You know, just trying to keep my head together, write a few new poems. I think that's what we're all trying to do. You know, and I've wish I had better luck at that, but the last few days haven't been bad.
Yeah, 2011 was a dark year, it seemed like. I'm hoping for a lot of good stuff to happen this year and a lot of good creativity for everybody.
Yeah, I'm, well, yeah, me too, man, me too, particularly with the creativity. I mean, I know Reberg will probably be listening to this tonight. I've been promising to get some new material to him for quite a while. The Prosperos guys are putting out a big book of my work sometime in the near future, as soon as I get it to them, probably about 400 pages. So
is that your next project?
Probably the biggest one. I just put together a little chapbook called White Girl Problems that I sent off to a publisher in Cleveland, but they're kind of like dragging ass about that. So I actually think I might potentially withdraw it, and they might be listening tonight. So if they are, hello. But you know, I don't really give a fuck. But you know, I don't know. I'm hoping that we can get together, do some third world cats appearances this year. That would be, you know, top on my list of things to do. And, you know, I'm going out and doing a tour in August with an old publisher friend of mine who is putting up some money for me to get a bunch of train tickets to, like, go across the country like crazy in August. So there's that. And I don't know. Too many things, man. Too many.
So why don't you give us a poem of your choice from any of your collections or a new one or something?
Let me give you a new one.
Okay.
All right. This poem called Masculinity, and all the poems I've been writing over the last few years have really been based on true stories. And this one is one of the darker things I've had to put together. It took me about a year to actually sit down and write. Masculinity. As kids, we never really understood that word. Virginity, like a strong drink, still frozen on our tongues, a time-tested truth. When we were 10 years old, molestation seemed like some invisible baseball metaphor, coined by the ghost of Steve McQueen. As I sit here now in a friend's kitchen, I wonder where it all went wrong. Chris and I used to talk about girls. Heaven in flower pattern dresses, blowing in fields of dandelions, without the benefit of one sex ed class. Chris, who was named after Christofferson, whose parents met in the same strip club we got our first beer in middle school. His mother dancing to the moonlight for a few dollars and a little hope. On a Sunday morning coming down from the night before, Chris, whose father wore an eye patch, while building computers in the upstairs bedroom of his grandmother's house, while masturbating to 70s porn on Beta, that he'd let us borrow if we promised to be quiet. We used to have pool parties on our birthdays and look up at the stars and the sky for guidance. We used to wander through lunch lines, clutching our milk money, wiping the sweat from George Washington's empty promises, without ever once thinking about heavy things like self-worth. Chris, who was the first guy I knew to go all the way, it didn't make any difference that it was with his mom. Back then, a boner was a sacred thing. And Paul and I asked him what it felt like to be a man. He said, sticky, and bragged about it for the next 2 or 3 years. While we dreamed about cheerleaders and bookish girls with black-rimmed glasses, and just getting to second base in our clubhouse in Paul's backyard, nothing seemed wrong then. We were kids who dreamt about a lot of things, none of them sad. Things like fast cars and kissing with our eyes closed, come prom night, whatever that was. It was in the distant future. Things like honor, like brotherhood, like family. We were going to make it out of that small Pennsylvania town together. But in my heart, we're still there, still 10 years old, still waiting for our dreams to come true. Sitting here now, I can still remember the in-depths of stripper poles and the carpet at the bar when we went back to town a few years after I served as best man at Chris's wedding to the wrong girl, just because he wanted to know what it felt like to have a normal family, what it felt like to truly be a man. The truth is, something tells me that the skeletons in our closets will be 10 years old forever, and that they will be anything but masculine.
Damn. That was fucking great, man. That was great. You wrote that one yesterday or today?
I wrote that at like probably like 3 in the morning between yesterday and today.
Damn. I really like the Steve McQueen bit at the beginning, too. That was excellent.
Oh, yeah, man. So, I mean, you can't, for me, like...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, man. Go ahead.
No. I just said yeah.
But, you know, for me, like, growing up as, like, a child of, like, the 70s, because I'm, you know, I'll be 36 later this year. I mean, I think for you, too, like, we're around the same age. Like, you don't get a lot of symbols of masculinity that are much bigger than Steve McQueen.
Nah, man, I remember seeing my first Steve McQueen movie with my dad in, like, 1980, because, you know, I was, like, 5 in the 70s, but it was, like, The Bounty Hunter or something. That was some badass shit, man.
yeah, man. Well, my dad, like, he was a military guy, so we, you know, if we went to see anything, it was, like, something like that. You know, he once told me that the last movie he saw by himself was that Charles Bronson movie, The Mechanic. You know,
nice.
The kind of guy. Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's not many good ones there in that in the world today. I think Clint Eastwood, but he's like 90 years old, man.
yeah. When he goes, that'll be a sad day. I mean, you know, what happened to like the American Badass? You know, all we have now are like rom-coms and Brian Hardy. So.
He's in a trunk somewhere, kicking still, man.
You know he is.
So one thing I noticed about, and like, you know, I've done, I don't know, like 4 or 5 readings or so around the various places with you, and one thing I noticed is when I hear you read or something is your flow is spot on all the time, and the words are excellent. I mean, is that for like the listeners out there, is that something that like, because I'm pretty sure that you knew, like, Greg Corso when you were younger. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah.
Did you learn stuff like that from him, or is that just something you just woke up with one day and you could just do it?
Well, I think what Gregory taught me is, like, he taught me more of, like, a self-confidence as a person, and that really, I was able to parlay that into, as a poet on the page, I feel like I have a real confidence there most of the time. In terms of performance, I'll be honest, man. Like about 10 years ago, I was, you know, I was shaky as hell, just like anybody. And then I don't know. I just got kind of into a comfort zone. I used alcohol for that at first, but now I don't need anything. I mean, it's the one thing I can do pretty much without fucking it up. If I could like translate that into human relationships, man, I'd be doing great.
So why don't you give us another poem?
All right, you got it. Let's see. I wrote this poem in Iowa, and it's this is really kind of all about flow, and it's just called the Iowa Sutra. I did not realize how liberal your daydreams were. Your corn-fed daughters offer 1,000 promises not yet broken by sunlight. Myth stands proud at the Grotto of Redemption. Here we're taught that no superhero is an island. Here we cut the umbilical cord of history without blinking. Where time is silent, where willows breathe easy and make for slender sundials. Here we look for bloodlines in the earth, for any reason to dry hump death. I want to flaunt my penis like a Greek tragedy, because the sign says don't die with your teeth out. I plan to live forever in the basement of your heart. Hotels make great lovers, but there aren't any waffles here, only fair-weather vaginas. Like toy soldiers, we cling to the roots of trees. I look up at the sky and cross my fingers, wondering what we give up for constellations. I look for messages in plastic bottles and name rivers after ghosts who were never told they were beautiful.
Damn. So, like, I a lot of times, like, when I was reading your New Jersey book, that Grievous Jones put that one out. So, I mean, it's sitting in New Jersey.
Yeah, they did. Unfortunately, they, as you might know, they're no more. They no longer exist. Now, my book on the press actually sold out, you know, which was fantastic. And David Apraba is a great guy and a great publisher, and he remains a close friend. So.
Yeah, that's one book that I have of yours that I was reading a lot a little while back. And I'm just a lot of times just blown away by your words. And it's not just necessarily about, yeah, the delivery is cool, but your actual words is what, to me, is what is important. You've got a great sense of storytelling, which I think, you know, is missed a lot in the poetry world today. I mean, you get a lot of, like, things that don't necessarily mean sense, but I guess some people have to go through that to get to the good stuff.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I think I went through that. I think, like, you know, when I started writing, and I really kind of started publishing at the beginning of the 90s, like, a lot of my work was just purely abstraction. It wasn't bad, but I think I had to really find narrative. I think it was a struggle. I think it was a struggle, and I think it is for a lot of people, because I don't, you know, I think when we start writing poetry, I don't think we lived enough in a lot of cases. And so we don't know what our story is yet. And, you know, nice for better story. For worse, I think I know what mine is now.
It was strange because, for me, like, it started out as narrative, and then I went into a two to three-year phase of the abstract kind of stuff. And I think you kind of, like, have to, for one day you're just whatever you're doing, you could walking down the street, and one day it just seems to click in your head. I mean, did it just happen, that process for you, or...?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely how it happened for me. And then, you know, one day I just kind of sat there and I figured out, like, it was just one poem that hit me and then one after another. And I actually, one of the first times that really, I wound up writing the bulk of those New Jersey poems when I was staying with Jason Hardung in Colorado. And it really kind of hit me there. And it really was brought on by Jason and his, like, as disorganized as he is and as chaotic as he is as a person, and he'll laugh when he hear me say that, like, he's one of the most disciplined writers I know. He would get up every day at the same hour, go to the same coffee shop and write in a room full of people, which I've never been good at. But with him there, I kind of got into that pattern, and I was able to find the narrative.
Definitely good. I was talking to, I think, my last show, Bill Taylor, and he was talking about, we discussed if there is any importance to the internet in this world. I mean, is besides the connecting with people, I mean, that's how I found people, or something like that. You started publishing 20 years ago when there really was no internet. What's the difference? Has it helped you, or is it burdened you more?
I'll say this, like, I'm very, very grateful that I started publishing when I did, I'm grateful that I was around back then because I would rather have both of those experiences. Like, because to start out, just to talk about that a little bit, it was so, you seem so isolated, and you would send these poems off in envelopes, like seemingly out to the void because you didn't know where they were going to go or end up. But the few friendships that you did make, like I've been friends with Bill since I was like a senior in high school, those friendships were so close, and they were made that much more close by the isolation. And you're right on the other end, because the networking of the internet, I'm happy that it's here. I'm happy that, you know, I'm happy that you and I met. I'm happy that I met a lot of people because of it. But I wouldn't trade either experience. You know, I think that there's something to be said for holding a publication in your hand, and I think a lot of young poets who didn't come up during that print era, they want to just jump from, okay, I'll post my poems to this blog, and then all of a sudden I want a book that's like 300 pages without doing any of the legwork, really, of doing some publishing first. I don't care if it's online or in print, but I really do think people should be willing to put in the sweat and put in the work. And I really think that that's one of the things that's missing largely in a lot of people.
I think that it's mainly, in some ways, it could be the internet with its instant gratification that it gives people. You know, they don't toil for hours over the poems. They don't, you know, they just, boom, instantly, here you go. And, you know, and now I'm supposed to be, I don't know, Charles Bukowski or something because I did that. I think that the internet can be a devil in that sort of way.
Well, I think that you're right. And, you know, I have my own, speaking of Charles Bukowski, I have my feelings on that too. I mean, I think a lot of young writers, because Bukowski's distribution at this point is so strong, that they really only come to know people like Bukowski or authors that are touchstones like Kerouac and Ginsberg and people like that. I think, you know, a lot of what coming up in print gave me is the knowledge of some authors that might be in these magazines that only have like 50 copy runs, 25 copy runs. And there were really some wonderful people. I mean, I discovered Todd Moore like 20 years ago, I think, in a magazine that ran like 15 copies. And, you know, I don't know if I ever would have found him, you know, in today's day and age of the internet. I don't know, and I don't know what the impact would have been.
Yeah, and then you miss out on like gems, like some of those Venice guys, Eugene Ruggles, all those types of guys that you probably wouldn't have heard of ever.
No, it's true. It's true. And I'm glad that you mentioned Eugene Ruggles, who everyone should seek out. His book, Lifeguard in the Snow, is freaking brilliant. And Gene was a friend of mine. And that came about is through a connection with Al Winans. But, yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of people you miss. And that's the same reason I'll never get a Kindle or anything like that. Not that I think that technology is the devil, but I think there are certain books that will never show up on a Kindle. If you press a book that has like a press run of like 100 copies, you're not going to find that in that format. So
nope.
Because of that, I just can't do it.
Yeah, I can't buy it either. I think it's because mine and yours generation, like, we didn't have internet most of our lives or text messaging or things like that. We came up with books, but these kids that are 20 now or 19 or whatever, that's all it's going to be. But I hate to say it, in 20 years or so, I think that's going to be all it's going to be anymore. I mean, there'll probably still be books, but not like it was.
Well, I think that's probably true, with the exception of small press. You know,
yes, of course.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that sort of revolution and that sort of thing will still be there. But, yeah, you're right, and thank God we weren't born, like, aren't children of this generation now. I'd rather be as old as I am.
So you were, I think I caught the tail end of something at the beginning of the show. You're doing, like, a 400-page book with the Prospero people. Do you want to talk about that a little better?
Well, yeah, I mean, Will... Will, who's one of the owners of the store, he got my New Jersey book. I sent him a copy, and he was really taken by it. And of course, you know, I'm friends with Reberg, and Reberg stayed at my place last August when everybody came in for the poetry festival here. And they've been wanting to do a book with me for a while, and I told them, like, what I really like to do at this point is collect all of my previous books so that I just purely for selfish reasons, I don't want to have to lug all that shit around when I'm traveling. I want to be able to condense it all into one book. And so Jason and Will offered to do that. And it's both within me, like, dragging my heels. It's not getting shit done because I've been too busy doing other stuff. But they're anxious to work with me, and I'm excited about that. And I finally came up with a title for that book today. It's going to be called Where There's Blood, There's a River.
Wow, nice, nice.
So,
why don't you give us another poem? By the way, before you start, there's a little over 20 minutes left. If somebody wants to call in and ask John a question, everybody, I know there's people listening. I know people are shy, but if you want to, you can now. But why don't you give us a poem?
Yeah, I definitely call in. I'll say my one sadness in life has been with poetry has been that no girl has ever stalked me. So if there are girls out there looking to do that. But, all right. This is a poem that I wrote last night, too. And it's, again, it's a true story, and it's called A Student of Drama. My mother used to make me watch soap operas with the volume turned up as she vacuumed the shag green carpet in our mobile home. What are they saying, she'd yell. When I suggested turning off the vacuum, she'd say that she didn't need to hear the words to understand the emotion. So I acted out murder plots, baby-switching scenarios, and scandalous love affairs like a pro, until it was time for the nightly news. The trailer park had its own storyline, filled with betrayal and broken dinner plates, vows hidden in ceramic cookie jars, and cast into the shadows of better memory. Later, she would make me do table readings of the Bible, while listening to Barry Manilow on A-Track, while we waited for Jesus to come back, while my dinner got cold. In our house, there was a thin line between salvation and product placement. Endearments came complete with theme music. I became a student of drama, who thought of heaven as some crumbling city with just enough commercial breaks to fill in the cracks.
Man, that's pretty, I don't know, man. Your stuff is just really great. So how's that beard coming along?
It's fucking huge, man. I could barely breathe. If I'm sitting on my couch with my laptop, I have to move my beard just to type. Like,
dude, so it's gone beyond the John Berryman now.
I think it probably is. It's like halfway down my stomach. So,
you're definitely into ZZ Top territory now.
Oh, definitely. Definitely, without a doubt. So.
Yeah, we definitely got to get together sometime and do the third world cat that we talked about. Maybe make it a fourth world cat and add Provost up in the Northeast sometime or something.
Yeah, that definitely would be cool. It definitely would be cool. I have a handful more poems I'm working on right now, but I'm writing one for you and for Jacob right now that's just called Brian Hardy's Mother. Hopefully
we got
we'll
a caller.
Be, ho-
we got a caller. We're going to bring him on. 412 area code.
That's,
hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm on.
John Darcy?
How are you guys doing tonight? I just wanted to say hi to John and say what's up. And I was just wondering where, I know, John, you get all over the country. I was just wondering where you're planning to head out now. Like, what are your plans?
I do get all over the country. I will be May 12th. I will be in Kingston, New York with Rebecca Shimada. And then I'm taking a long break unless someone else wants me to come somewhere. And then in August, I will be in Sacramento at Luna's with D.R. Wagner in California. I'll be in Los Angeles. I'll probably be in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Really kind of trying to figure it out. I have a tour manager for the August thing, so we're going to kind of be all over. I know we're going to be, plan is to be in Denver. They'll hook up with Jason Hardung. And then next year I'm going to be in London, and David Aprava and I are trying to put that together as we speak. So.
Oh, cool. I was just curious because, I mean, I've seen you read a bunch of times, met a bunch of times, and it's always great to see you. So I was just wondering, what your plans are, and I figured I'd, call up and let you know. I know a lot of people are out there listening. I could tell you that, some of us are actually, sort of listening and talking about the books and the different things you've been reading, which the internet is pretty cool because you can do that. So, yeah, so I know people are out there right now tuning in. So just figured I'd, say hello and thank you for reading tonight and wish you guys luck with the show.
Oh, well, appreciate it. Appreciate it. I'm actually shocked that we have some live listeners.
Oh, you do.
After 20 years, I'm still shocked that people actually like a poem from time to time. It's still surprising to me, which is probably a good thing, because you want to stay restless like that.
Right. No, we're out there and we're listening, and, I hope Frank knows that, we're out there. I'm sure he does. Sometimes people are kind of funny about calling in, or they don't know what to say. And I think, sometimes it's cool to just, call up and let people know that you're, listening and you're appreciating what they're reading and I guess I'll let you guys get back to it and thank you. Bye.
That was Lynn Alexander, who did not leave her name.
Yeah. But, well, it took me about like 30 seconds to be like, okay, that's Lynn. All right.
So we got 15 minutes. Why don't you give us another poem? Trying to squeeze in few more.
Sure. Let's see here. I'll read this. But I want to say that I think when my work really changed, like the one thought I'll give before I get into the poem, is when I Gregory Corso died in 2001, and I really didn't do anything for like a year after that. I kind of went into shock, didn't talk to much of anyone, and then shortly after I met S.A. Griffin and Scott Wanberg, and it really changed my life. Scott, you're out there somewhere. And I miss you. And I want to read a short poem for Scott. But first, I want to read this poem from Harvey Keitel, Harvey Keitel, Harvey Keitel, which is a book we all did together, which some people may know, some people may not. The piece is called Small Miracles. I met this guy who believed the conception was his birthday. So he was always 9 months older than everyone else he knew. Said he could feel his father's father's penis bitch-lapping his brain like a rubber chicken. He worked as magician in Coney Island to buy dank blueberry nuggets and sold methadone to 12-year-old prostitutes in need of backstory. That was his daily alibi for not attending the second coming of Jesus, wandering the earth like that cat on Kung Fu, and saying, I'm not God, but merely his stepson. And when he slept on our couch, he could make 8 balls disappear. And like Ray Slick, he sang odes to white rabbits in the shower that were touching. And then when he was told by the Great Spirit that he had 9 months to live, he just laughed, feeling like he had already cheated death, saying that he couldn't conceive of a death worse than the one he had just lived through. He was his shadow's best-kept secret, gambling with belief systems, walking on water every time it rained. He was God. It was in his blood, like holy water.
Damn. Yeah, that's a book is that one out of print now?
What's that?
Is that book out of print now, the Harvey Keitel book? It's an older book,
is it not? The book was from 2005. And it was jointly published by SA and David Greenspan from Butcher Shop Press and the Temple of Man in Beverly Hills. And it is out of print. But you can find copies of it on 8 Books and, like, Amazon. You know, so it's out there.
So why don't you give us that Scott Blomberg poem?
Sure, let me...
If you want.
I will grab that. It's just a short little poem based on a very true story. Scott and I were in Sacramento probably like 5 years ago, and we're outside this bookstore, and we wind up in the back of this hatchback with a man, really old man in his 70s by the name of Gene Bloom, who's a wonderful poet, but he has this bong in his car, and Scott and I, he's like, you know, do you guys want to hit this bong? And so we do, and the car's full of smoke. And then after the fact, I find out that Gene, the guy who gave us the weed, had been to prison in Sing Sing for, like, marijuana trafficking. So I thought to myself, man, it might not be the guy that you really want to smoke weed with in a hatchback in the middle of, like, suburbia. But as a result, I wrote this poem. It's called 1,000 Dead Abby Hoffmans. I will remember you this way, bong in hand, inhaling the fears of 1,000 dead revolutionaries. Mid-afternoon in the Sacramento sun, where Abby Hoffman became a rosary. What can I say? You knew Mambo when you saw it. New dreams by the way they kissed your skin for a taste of freedom.
Damn. So that was, you know, it's been about 8 months already since Scott has gone, and that was such a young guy, well, in his 50s, to go so soon. I mean, what did that, was he like a major influence on you like he was me? Or
He was. I've known Scott probably at that point for, about 7 years, somewhere in that neighborhood when he passed away. And, you know, it's a loss that still, it kind of sits there with me. It really hasn't, you know, I still don't know what I think about it. But one thing that I am really grateful for, you know, there are legions of people out there who, when Scott passed away, they expressed, like, their sadness and how close they were to him. And I'm sure that's all true. And I know that they're really sad, but I'm very grateful that I got to know the man in the flesh and have that, you know, have that time to have those travels with him and, you know, share a Guinness with him. It was a good time.
Yeah, I was completely blown away the times that I met him, and even the phone calls when he called. Like, you'd just say hello, and there'd be, like, a song going on for, like, 10 minutes before he even said anything. But, you know, definitely miss
my,
that guy.
My favorite Scott story, actually, is we were somewhere in Northern California. I think we were in Stockton or something like that. And we were at a Denny's, like, at, like, 4 in the morning, like, in the middle of freaking nowhere. And it was really cold, because even though it would have been spring. We were there with Ellen Mabee and with S.A., and Ellen spent, like an hour trying to decide between ordering, like, a cup of cocoa or a bowl of rice pilaf. And after about an hour of this, like, Scott couldn't even take it anymore, and he was like, oh, Ellen, just get the fucking pilaf. And, and you know, it's just that sense of humor, like a real humanity. And even that wasn't said with, like, any malice or, like, you know, it's just, Scott being Scott, and he was a great guy. So,
yeah, we got about a little over 7 minutes, so if you want to give us one more poem, and then we'll talk about where to get your stuff to the listeners.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. Let's see. I'm trying to decide between reading a more current poem from the New Jersey book or reading an old poem. I'll stick with the book. This is probably the closest poem I have to, like, an autobiography. because every fucking thing in here is true, and it's called The Year Joe Brainard Died. The year Joe Brainard died, I was in high school. The papers didn't mention anything. It was the year of Charles Bukowski, Kurt Cobain, and the Teatro Cafe. All of the kids I knew were busy wearing a heart-shaped box on their sleeve. I carried a Trapper Keeper with kittens on it. My poems tucked inside. Sitting in the local mall, my friend Mike Mason shaking as he read one aloud. Smoking countless Swisher Sweet cigars with conviction. I don't remember the conversation, only that Mike drove a beat-to-shit 73 Nova and that he spent $60 on egg rolls in 2 days because he had a crush on a girl that worked at the food court, who would later take out a restraining order. Those were the days pre-Trenchcoat Mafia. Before Bill Clinton forgot to take that dress to the dry cleaners, I did inhale. Soul Nirvana just walks away at Tingles in 1991. Kids today don't smoke like they mean it. I remember that Mike had a nervous condition, had been through the ninth grade 3 times and was working on a 4th. I remember we ran into this kid I knew from elementary school who looked exactly like Lee Majors. I remember that was the year JP and I watched the Stones for the first time, from nosebleed seats at Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh, trading a poorly rolled joint for a couple of beers. I remember later that night sitting on the curb talking to strippers from the Good and Plenty bar while we waited for my aunt to pick us up. Hey, Joe, I think of you now, and I remember many things. I remember using a rolled-up Atlantic City sweatshirt as a pillow on hot summer nights in South Philly. I remember making out with Lauren Snow in a treehouse in Penn Hills at the age of 9, around the same time my grandmother died. I remember Gregory getting me a prostitute for the first time. I remember Randall Tex Cobb passed out drunk on a Center City sidewalk at noon. I remember running into him weeks later, and then he took everyone to see Spider-Man down by the docks. I still have the popcorn box he signed, but I haven't talked to Tyrone in years. I remember the poncho Brenda brought back from Bolivia. I still have it. She has 2 children now. I remember drinking for the first time. Airline bottles of vodka on a swing set, age 11. I didn't stop flying for years. I remember thoughts of suicide at 10, having to wear a plastic leg brace everywhere I went, and how having cerebral palsy meant I wasn't normal. I remember nights that are still going on somewhere, drunk with Fred, at the Cheap Art Cafe. It's gone now. I remember Christina's smell, how it stayed on my sheets for months after she was gone. I remember my first lie. I wish it had been my last. I remember holding hands with Caroline while sitting on a bench by the Jewish cemetery in Rossford, Ohio. I remember that I haven't been in love since Jessica left. I remember that every day, whether I want to or not. Thanks for the memories, Joe. I think of you often lately. Can't say I remember you, but from what I've heard, you were the stuff ghosts write love songs about. So tonight when I go to sleep, I will try to remember the last words you sang in your dream.
Damn. That was excellent. That all your stuff is just so good. So we got 3 minutes. Why don't you, if you want to tell us, the listeners, where you can get your stuff or what's going on with you?
Where you can get my stuff, it's kind of random. You can find old stuff on Amazon and Abe and places like that. I did a chapbook last year called Leave the Bath for Murphy Clamrod's Unadorned Press. And if you get a hold of Murphy on Facebook or Unadorned Press, I believe you can get a copy of that. I did a little chapbook called Bill Roberts from Bottle of Smoke Press called The Death of Language, and that's still available at Bottle of Smoke. Other than that, my work is pretty much out of print because, thank God, for one reason or another, I've been able to sell a hell of a lot of books. And I don't know who's looking out for me on that end. But I don't know, man.
Yeah, and if anybody out there is not friends with John Dorsey, you could find him through my Facebook page and connect with him and find out all that kind of good stuff or whatever. He's definitely one of the better poets I know in the world, better writers, I should say, and I don't know, it was a pleasure having you on, old friend. I'm sure I'll be in contact with you.
I'm sure you will. And, yeah, like Frank said, if you don't know me, if you want to, friend me on Facebook, stalk me, send me your underwear. I'm all about it.
Just as long as it's not some guy named Hugo's underwear, I would assume.
Yeah, I don't want Juice or Brian Hardy to get any ideas.
Because Juice is the sunshine. He always will be.
He's the reason I get up in the morning, I'll tell you that.
All right, man. The lady just said it's time to cut off in a second, so it was great to have you on. I love all your stuff, and it's good to be friends. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, it certainly is, man, and I'll talk to you soon, and I appreciate it. And my love to Becky Shimada, if she's listening, the only shout-out I'll give. And thanks a lot, man.
All right. You have a good one, man.
All right. Bye.
All right. Okay, that was tonight. So, you know, hook up with John and get his stuff because he's one of the better voices out there. And next week's guest will be R.L. Raymond of Pigeon Bike Press and his Son of a Bitch poems collection. So, and after that, the following week will be Dan Fonte. So, I don't know. However.